I'm Jason Klom, and this is the Comedy on Vinyl podcast. Hi, everybody. It's Jason Klom. This week, we're not talking about a particular album, but I do have, you know, I didn't ask you, do you want me to call you John Schwartz? John Bermuda Schwartz?
Today, I'm Bermuda.
You're Bermuda today.
Yes.
All right. Bermuda Schwartz is in the studio with me. So let's talk about your influences. So I know that I emailed you a long time ago, and you're like, I didn't listen to a lot of comedy albums. That's fine. You're on a lot of comedy albums I listen to, so I'd still want to talk to you about your influences.
Okay.
So you're a master mimic in terms of, and maybe that's by, maybe because you had to be, or is that something that you've always done?
I think I've always done that. I always heard stuff on records and on the radio, and I always imitated that. So
yeah.
I was already tuned into hearing something and duplicating it.
Mm-hmm.
And or trying to duplicate it. So, you know, Al didn't have to get me up to speed at all. I was already there. I was already on board with him mm-hmm. and the way he wanted to do things.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the earliest stuff, I grew up in listening to music in the early 60s and into the 70s, of course. And, you know, my parents had, I did have, you know, some comedy albums in the house.
Mm-hmm.
Had Alan Sherman.
Sure.
And, you know, some kind of things like that and some Jewish comedian albums and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And, but my parents also had Latin orchestras and Gene Krupa records and
sure.
stuff like that. And by the time I started becoming aware of a lot of pop music, the Beatles had just hit. I was sitting in front of the TV on February 9th, 1964.
Wow.
Like millions of others were.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Beatles, of course, were a big influence. You know, a little later, Frank Zappa and sort of his humorous take on a lot of stuff.
Sure.
You know, as it turns out, Al listened to a lot of the same stuff that I did.
Okay.
I mean, he was just a couple of years behind me,
mm-hmm.
age-wise.
Yeah.
But he was a big fan of the Beatles and the Kinks and the Monkees and the Rolling Stones and Zappa. And, you know, we listened to a lot of the same stuff. And we also both listened to the Dr. Demento show. I think I started listening probably in 71
mm-hmm.
or so.
And, how early is that into the run of the show? Very early.
I think within just a year.
Yeah, okay. That makes sense. Wow.
That must have been like the first year.
Yeah, yeah.
I know they called 1991 his 20th anniversary. So
oh, okay, yeah, all right.
70 or 71 would have been when he started
mm-hmm.
Here in Los Angeles.
Gosh.
And so I was right on board with that,
mm-hmm.
As was Al, as were a ton of people in high school and junior high.
Yeah.
So it's what we listened to.
Did you have a ton of friends who also listened to Demento with you, or was it your thing where you were?
No, a bunch of people, friends and also bandmates and
okay.
school orchestra and stuff like that. And those were the people that worked with me on Pico and Sepulveda
mm-hmm.
and The Ballad of Wootsie Owl
mm-hmm.
Mr. Ghost Goes to Town.
Okay. Yeah.
So gosh. They were, you know, they weren't just, oh, we have to do a music project. It's like, cool, we're going to send something to Dr. Demento.
That's so great.
And so it was, although all of that stuff, I mean, I really shouldn't have taken credit for it. I mean, I sort of organized it and I was the contact person, but I certainly didn't write any of the songs.
Mm-hmm.
I really didn't sing or very much on any of the songs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yet it became known as the John Schwartz Project.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay.
actually, I think at the time it was just John Schwartz, and later on, in deference to all of them, we agreed that John Schwartz Project was a little more inclusive.
Okay.
And you know, that was the beginning for me, you know, with catering to Dr. Demento a little bit at a time when not many people were sending homemade tapes.
Yeah.
I was literally the second or third person ever to get a homemade tape played on his show.
That's insane.
Which is what prompted the interview in 1980 where I met Al.
Yeah. Oh
so
my god.
That's a very quick history of that brings us up from the Beatles to Al.
Mm-hmm.
A strange trip. What a short, strange trip it's been.
You know, you mentioned in your email the Beatles, and the other day I actually had another drummer on the podcast. His name is Tony Thaxton. He's a great drummer and also just a very funny dude. And we were drawing all kinds of just comparisons between like how comedians learn to mimic when they're young, and the same as drummers. The same, maybe most musicians are just going to learn, of course, by listening first. I would, unless you're Mozart, which you seem to be able to pick it up and immediately. But he mentioned the Beatles, and I was like, you know what? We could have talked about the Beatles as a comedy group. He's like, well, shoot, we should have done that. Because I don't know, was it just their music, or did you like them as funny guys too? Did you watch the movies?
Well, yeah, I was right there with Hard Day's Night and Help and eventually Magical Mystery Tour, which was, I don't know if it was intentionally funny. But
right.
I was all the TV appearances and stuff like that, and the teen magazines and books that were coming out and mm-hmm. all of that stuff. I was right there, got every album, you know, whenever a new album was coming out, there was always, you know, that was a birthday present or a Christmas present or a, you know, I did good in school present or whatever it was, you know, that was always my reward, was getting an album.
That's great.
Bought the singles. I mean, I was really, really into that.
Yeah.
You know, probably more so than other contemporary groups like the Beach Boys at the time and the Stones at the time even. I mean, I came to appreciate those groups later on.
Sure.
When the Monkees came along, that was what the prefab for.
Yeah.
They referred to them. And there was a lot of that kind of, very obviously, deliberately, you know, the comedy and, you know, the interaction between the guys, and a lot of good music, a lot of great music, you know, written by a lot of great songwriters.
Yeah.
So that was the attraction too, mm-hmm. you know, for that. So I guess really most important was the music mm-hmm. for me, and as it is with anybody.
Of course. What bands before you got to Al, what bands were you in? Because I read off of your website just that you seemed to be in a bunch of bands beforehand.
I played with a bunch of different people. I think my first real band was 1970 or 71 mm-hmm. with some guys from school. Not my school, from another school.
That's funny.
Which at the time was unheard of. I mean, you really didn't have a way of connecting with people.
Yeah.
You know, unless you went to school with them or they lived in your neighborhood. And I honestly don't remember how I got hooked up with them.
Uh-huh.
But they went to Culver High.
Uh-huh.
And I was at Hamilton High.
Okay.
And they'd come over to the house. And it was a very odd, it was a treat. Well, they played together.
Okay, okay.
One guy played flute, one guy played piano.
All right.
They called themselves R&T Unlimited,
mm-hmm.
and the R was Jeff Rona.
Okay.
Jeff became, he does a lot of Hollywood TV scores and stuff like that.
Okay, okay.
He got seriously into the business. And the T was Bill Turner.
Okay.
And Bill played piano. He could play trumpet, he played guitar, he could play drums. He was one of those guys that could put his hands on an instrument and make it work.
Jeez.
And sound really good mm-hmm. at it. But no bass player at the time.
Okay.
So they'd come over. We had a piano in the house, and I'd bring my drums downstairs into the living room where the piano was,
mm-hmm.
and they'd ride their bikes over.
Sure.
And, you know, no amps, no nothing. You know, the flute player would have the flute, you know, in a backpack, and that was it.
Yeah.
And we'd play just drums, bass, and piano. I'm sorry, drums, flute, and piano.
That's crazy.
Now, my archiving began at that point.
Really?
I'm well known as Al's archivist.
Yeah.
And a lot of stuff. I made tapes of every rehearsal that we did, reel to reel.
Amazing.
Tapes.
Yeah.
And all of that's been committed now to digital.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why. I must have been very proud of myself and thought that'd be cool stuff to have.
Mm-hmm.
And as it turns out, it was cool stuff.
Do you listen back often? Two separate questions.
I have.
Mm-hmm.
And not terribly often.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, it's interesting. You know, it was very early on in my drumming experience. I'd only been drumming for about five years.
Okay, okay.
And not really, you know, not doing anything professionally.
Mm-hmm.
And because I wasn't experienced, I did a lot of things that weren't the norm.
Sure,
you know,
okay.
That weren't maybe considered to be right. And therefore, some of them were actually pretty cool, because I just took chances
mm-hmm.
and did some pretty cool things. I also did some really bad things. So I listen, and it's like, you know, it's like, oh, I would never do that now. And then, mm-hmm. you know, it's like, God, I'm so glad I don't. And then I listen to other things. It's like, God, I would never do that now. I'm like too much I'm too much in a box now to do things a certain way. I would never go outside of the box like I did back then without even thinking about it, without knowing. And it's like you learn to be sort of in a box.
Yeah.
Now, the cool thing is there's a bunch of money in the corner of that box.
Of course,
And in a little dark corner of the box. It's great.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I listen to stuff. It's like, God, I would never play those parts now, and it's too bad.
Yeah. Were you self-correcting as a quote-unquote better drummer, or just as a more experienced drummer? Or was it like, did you take lessons? Were you working with other people who are drummers? Or was it just self-correcting?
Well, I did take lessons,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of it was, you know, I would, and at the time I would listen to these tapes
mm-hmm.
and to hear back what I had done.
Okay.
And so I was able to hear things I knew back then. It's like, that's not working.
Mm-hmm.
And then I knew back then also, it's like, wow, that was a really cool lick.
Yeah.
And listening to that stuff 40 plus years later, it's like, yeah, that's still, that's a cool lick.
Mm-hmm.
I have to remember that. I have to, you know, bring that back into rotation. Right. And then other things I did, it's like, boy, I'm so glad I grew up and got out of doing that kind of miserable stuff.
Yeah.
But interestingly, the two guys, and we added a bass player soon mm-hmm. after that, and the order of it is, we first did Pico and Sepulveda.
Yeah.
Sent that into Dr. Benno. That was April of 1973.
Right, okay.
And we sent that in, and it got, came in second out of like over 100 entries of local people. Now, the show was only local at the time. It mm-hmm. wasn't national. And we came in second. And because it was an instrumental,
mm-hmm.
Dr. Demento played it as his theme song for some time because he could talk over it.
Right, of course.
You know, without obscuring the lyrics that we didn't do.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
shortly, now, one other interesting note. Al had also submitted an entry mm-hmm. to the Pico and Sepulveda contest.
Really?
As I learned more about it, mm-hmm. at first I thought, you know, well, he didn't. Now, Dr. Demento played the top 10 entries that night, and we didn't know until we heard it come on the radio
that
we had placed at all.
That's great.
Al was not in there. And I thought, oh, you know, poor Al didn't make it into the top. Well, it turns out, I just found out recently from Dr. Demento, Al submitted his tape too late.
Oh, no.
he gave it to Dr. Demento personally
uh-huh.
at an after-school assembly at Linwood High
uh-huh.
in April or maybe late April of 83.
Mm-hmm.
And it was too late to be submitted to me. And Demento put it in the trunk of his car. It stayed in there. He sold the car.
Oh, no.
And it's probably somebody saw that and erased over it
of course.
Threw it out.
Oh, that's heartbreaking.
So there's apparently not a recording of this anywhere.
Oh, no.
And in those days, you recorded something on a cassette and you just sent it off. You didn't keep a copy. So there's no, well, he says there's no copy of it.
Right.
Anyway, so there were a number of players on, mm-hmm. on this Pico and Sepulveda thing, some from my school
mm-hmm.
and some from other schools. We had a guy named Barry Keyes on trombone. Barry, mm-hmm. I think, went on to play in the Tonight Show Band.
Wow.
For a time. We had this Jeff Rona was in there, Bill Turner. Had a couple of people from the school orchestra at Hamilton High at mm-hmm. the time. We had a guy named Richard Elliott on sax.
Mm-hmm.
Richard Elliott's a very well-known sax player.
Okay.
Now, he's not, if you name the top five sax players, you know, you first say, well, Kenny G, everyone knows Kenny.
Sure.
Richard would be in that top five
that's
as
amazing.
Well.
That's amazing. Shows how much I know about music, of course, that I'm hearing this all for the first time, but that's amazing.
And there was someone else as well. I can't think of every, I've got it all written down somewhere.
Sure.
Anyway, the core of that went on. We decided that beginning of 1974, we recorded another song, The Ballad of Woodsy Owl.
Uh-huh.
Now, that was just, Jim Walker on bass, Bill Turner on piano, Jeff Rona on, I don't know if he, I guess he was playing flute.
Okay.
My brother came in and played something on it.
Okay.
Played maybe guitar or banjo or something. There were basic drums on there. And then I sort of sang,
uh-huh.
you know, the lyrics, not very well. Even though I wasn't singing, you could tell I couldn't sing. And we sent that in and that got played.
That's so good.
Well, it's I was graduating in 74,
mm-hmm.
The other guys, you know, were still at this other high school, and we somehow wangled our way into the L.A. County Battle of the Bands. This was like a real Battle of the Bands.
Yeah.
Sponsored by the city, Parks uh-huh. and Recreation, I think, sponsored it, and they had prelims at some of the different schools around, and somehow I had gotten hooked up with... Well, I know I was seeing a girl at Culver High.
Okay.
That I had met through these other guys.
Mm-hmm.
And back in the day, I used to leave my high school at noon
mm-hmm.
and go over to Culver High and go have lunch there when uh-huh. you could go walk on someone else's campus.
Sure.
Go have lunch and then go sit in on the classes for periods 5 and 6, like in theater arts and in their band classes.
Okay.
I ended up playing with their stage band for something. I don't know why. That would never happen now.
That's
you
great.
Could never do that. And, but we went through all the prelims as a combo group, the four of us, Jim, Bill, Jeff, and I, and we made it to the Hollywood Bowl finals and played the Hollywood Bowl. It was not my 74 was not still not my first time at the Hollywood Bowl.
Uh-huh.
I did something there with a marching band a couple of times,
wow.
but this was pretty cool, you know, where when the four of us were playing, there were like people just watching us.
That's insane.
And we tied for first place.
Wow.
On that. They made up an album, which I'm sure only the people who
were
in the thing bought copies. I was, see, even then, I was smart. I bought two albums.
Of course.
One to keep, one to have.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so one is open,
mm-hmm.
and one is still sealed.
Oh, man.
And so that was pretty cool. So, you know, we essentially won the 1974 in the combo division.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that anybody else from that competition went anywhere. Didn't mm-hmm. I mean, we certainly didn't as a band.
Right.
However, Jeff Rona won Instrumentalist of the Night.
Really?
For his flute playing.
That's awesome.
So he was already, you know, he was already spotted as being a talent.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the judges were Pete Christlieb, who was one of the studio, I think a flute or a sax player.
Okay, okay.
Tom Scott. Mm-hmm. Mercer Ellington, who is Duke Ellington's son.
All right.
And some other, you know, like an industry heavyweight was there, and they were the judges.
That's great.
At the bowl. So that was pretty cool. Anyway, we gradually, as they graduated high school, we did one more thing, and this is like June of 75. A long time between these things that we recorded for Dr. Demento.
Mm-hmm.
We did Mr. Ghost Goes to Town.
Uh-huh.
And sent that in. And that got played.
That's so good.
And still gets played every couple of Halloweens.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, we didn't do much musically. You know, I want to say that was my first group,
mm-hmm.
R&T Unlimited, or actually we called ourselves Pursuit.
Okay.
By the time we were doing the Hollywood Bowl thing, it was Pursuit.
Mm-hmm.
And within a few years after that, we sort of all went our separate ways. Sure. Somebody went to school, or I went and got a job, or whatever it was. Anyway, but I wasn't in another group, like really in a group, until maybe 78, 79, I met some guys, and met a gentleman named Joe Nipper.
Mm-hmm.
And Joe and his brother Scott Nipper, and a guy who played trumpet, harmonica, saxophone, flute, named Kevin Anderson, William K. Anderson, had me do some demos with them. I was doing a lot of demos in the late 70s around town. And mm-hmm. I'd run into these guys, and I can't remember how I met them, but we wound up doing this group called Nipper.
Uh-huh.
And we did all the new wave clubs around town.
That's awesome.
Yeah, made nothing.
Mm-hmm, of course.
You know, put together, made up a single,
mm-hmm.
and I did up the artwork for the single. Now, back then, we didn't have computers.
Sure.
This is like 1980. So no computers, no Photoshop, you know, not for me.
Mm-hmm.
So literally, I was doing rub-on letters, letraset.
Really?
By a big sheet of letters.
Yeah.
And you know, there'd be like, you know, in a very limited selection of typefaces, and you'd mm-hmm. get a whole font, you know, all the characters in this particular typeface. Pioneer. Helvetica,
mm-hmm.
you know, stuff like that. There were maybe a dozen that you could get.
Yeah.
And I had this nylon burnishing tool, you know, with kind of a little bit of a soft point on it that you could actually rub the letter on and completely rub it on.
Okay.
And I knew how to draw blue lines because when you shot it to be reproduced, the blue would disappear.
Don't show up, right? Yeah.
And it was all very, and so I did all the layouts for that. I did the photos. Again, no help from Photoshop.
Yep.
Developed photos and cut them up and lined them up and did this whole thing and put together all the art for the label and the artwork on a sleeve for the single.
That's great.
We did. So even then, I was sort of involved a little bit in the logistics of doing stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And September 14th, 1980. Now, I'm still working with Nipper at the time. I'm working at North Hollywood Speedometer,
mm-hmm.
which was, one, a speedometer repair shop.
Okay.
As well as an off-road equipment shop, lighting and different kinds of things that they'd have for different cars. And I mm-hmm. worked in shipping and receiving there. And I had come from a Cadillac dealer
okay.
in Glendale, went to work there, and it was during that time I met Al.
Yeah.
And we recorded another one, Rides the Bus.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what the exact words I said, but folklore suggests that it was, hey, Al, you should have a band. I'll be your drummer.
Yeah, yeah.
and those fateful words.
Yeah, right.
So, you know, when we all, and he was still in school at Cal Poly San Luis Obispo, we went about our business. And about 3 weeks later, he calls and says, remember that another one rides the bus? It's like it's getting played nationally.
That's insane.
I said, what happened?
Mm-hmm.
Well, now by this time, the Dr. Demento show is syndicated nationally.
Sure, yeah.
Well, what would happen is in all these major markets, you know, and Demento usually ran on Sunday nights when a radio station had run out of stuff, and they would just
okay.
you know, run stuff at 8 p.m. or 10 p.m. sometimes. And it was very kind of a little niche thing and tucked away, but, you know, it didn't interfere with the rest of their broadcast week.
Sure.
Well, what had happened is in a lot of these markets, the Monday morning, you know, zoo wacky DJ guys had come in. They'd listen to the Dr. Demento show that aired that night, mm-hmm. you know, and scour it for fun stuff to play.
Yeah, all right.
And so within a few weeks of us doing it here in Los Angeles, doing it live, and happily Dr. Demento recorded it.
Sure.
Now it was heard like in major markets. Now these guys are grabbing it. They're playing it in morning drive time.
That's crazy.
Which is huge.
Of course.
And that's really where things took off. That's not just, I don't want to downplay Al's Capital single from a year before. My Bologna came out in December of 79.
Mm-hmm.
A one-shot Capital deal.
Yeah.
Very niche thing.
Yeah.
But, you know.
Is that single one that's available? Like that people, or is that more of the collector's item version?
Well, it's collector's item
yeah,
now.
Yeah.
But it's, they're out there. I mean, Capital distributed it. Mm-hmm. It was out in other countries.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was a legitimate issue, but it was strictly a novel.
Yeah.
A novelty thing. And I don't think they or Al thought it would go any further. It was a one-shot deal.
That's interesting.
In fact, I guess when it came time to shop labels, they must have gone back and talked to Capital, and Capital probably said, "Nah, we already put something out
that.
On him.
Yeah.
Enough already with the accordion." And so Al's telling me, you know, about, you know, this is taking off. I've got a manager. I'm going to be home in January. I want to get back together. We want to record a few things. We'll put out an EP, and you know, let's do this.
Mm-hmm.
So he did, and we did, and I didn't do the artwork on this time. He and a buddy of his, photographer friend named Bill Burke,
mm-hmm.
also known as Beefalo Bill,
uh-huh.
Did the photography and I think the layout. No letter set this time. Well, actually, there was some, but the back of it was a lot of hand-drawn text.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a very rare. That's on the Placebo label.
Okay.
And that's a very rare. They did 1,000 of them.
Oof.
And in fact, Al and I drove all over town and went to Rhino Records and mm-hmm. Music Pluses and Tower Records and stuff and dropped off, you know, can we drop off 5 of these singles, you know,
yeah,
10
yeah,
of
yeah.
these singles. Anyway, and up until recently, I know Al was still sitting on 100 of them. So there's not that many out there.
Oh, my God.
I mean, that's not the rarest thing that would have Al
sure.
on it.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
But I mean, probably the rarest things are the Dr. Demento shows,
mm-hmm.
where there would be, well, the rare ones are on reel-to-reel tape.
Yes, yeah.
But he was airing on 170, 180 radio stations back in the 80s. And Westwood One, who was a syndicator, would literally press up that many, they would duplicate that many tapes or later press up that many sets of LPs.
Yeah.
A dozen extras. So they would do like 190 or 195 shows,
mm-hmm.
and that was it.
Yeah.
So that's a much lower number, obviously, than 1,000.
Sure.
And plus, those are spread out across the country. So those are really hard to find. I have every one of them.
Do you? Wow.
But where Al is interviewed, or the Funny 25 show
mm-hmm.
as well, are archivable, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've noticed that around, at least at Record Surplus in Santa Monica, every once in a while you can find some Dementos, but nothing that I'd be looking for Weird Al. Like, that would specifically be what I'd be looking for.
Yeah, every show that, and later on CD... every show that had an interview, I think, qualifies as something that's worth, you know,
sure.
you could, I mean, Al was played on probably every show since 1976.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it would be, you know, you can't put them all in the archive.
Of course.
That's too nuts.
Yeah. Yeah.
But an interview is a special thing,
mm-hmm.
or an appearance in the Funny 25 or the Funny 50 or whatever it is,
mm-hmm.
the end of the year show is a special thing.
Yeah.
So those are in the archive, and I have copies of all of those. Now, having worked at Westwood One, that was an easy thing for me to do.
Okay. Yeah.
Just took one off the top.
Of course. Why not?
So.
What was Doc? You know, I've never been able to talk to anybody who listened to Demento from the beginning. I talked to people who lived in different parts of the country, and I never got to hear it. I didn't know who Dr. Demento was till high school, and somebody gave me a CD that it was a compilation. And so what was Demento's show before people were submitting stuff? That's what I always think of, is people submitting stuff.
Well, it was, you know, he's very much of a musicologist.
Sure, yeah.
I mean, extremely knowledgeable, old jazz, and, you know, really the history of 20th century music is his thing. There's a lot of kind of one-hit, I don't want to call them one-hit wonders, but a lot of sort of novelty things,
mm-hmm.
but a lot of very cool, obscure jazz stuff. So a lot of the stuff he played old vaudeville things, you know, or things from the 50s, 40s, you know, some big band stuff a little bit,
mm-hmm.
but with a leaning towards the novel,
mm-hmm.
and novel being both comedic and also rare.
Yeah.
So it was a very, you know, it wasn't just a lot of wacky stuff. And I mean, the show did eventually become a lot of just sort of wacky. It really focused on the comedy. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing.
Sure.
It's just it evolved throughout the 80s, throughout the 70s, mm-hmm. rather. In fact, by the time I got to meet Dr. Demento and was asked if I would do an interview, mm-hmm. it was in the summer of 1980 he asked. And it was because at this point his show, you know, was comprised of a lot of stuff that people send in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in fact, a lot of well-known, Al was one of them.
Yeah.
You know, but I was one of the, I was very early on. It was like me, Ogden Edsel.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. Probably, you know, in 73, it was, you know, I mean, so, and also, of course, I was playing around town at the time with Nipper. So Dr. Demento thought, well, I could give that a little bit of a plug, but it might be cool to get one of the early people on there.
Yeah.
That's anyway, insane. And of course, I met Al and another one rides the bus and the whole, you know, I'll be your drummer thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, but his show was, it had a very different tone early on. But he would play, you know, the Flying Saucer records, you know, Buchanan mm-hmm. and Goodman,
mm-hmm.
You know, other, the Stan Freberg. Now, Stan was a huge hero to Al.
Yeah.
And, Spike Jones, you know, so it was all very kind of cool stuff, but with a leaning towards the novel. But mm-hmm. there'd be Big Spider Beck stuff. I mean, there'd be some very cool old jazz stuff, you know, 20s and 30s stuff.
Yeah.
So it was kind of all over the place. And later, you know, by the mid to late 70s, it had become focused on comedy and novelty.
Yeah.
And with a leaning towards, you know, a lot of sort of independent or / homemade music,
mm-hmm.
you know, again, of which Al was one.
Sure.
And he had become the most requested artist on the show.
That's crazy.
I mean, perhaps even before the record deal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think because Dr. Demento's fan base knew who Al was.
Yeah.
He was the resident songwriter.
Yeah.
He was on the show, you know, almost every week.
Right.
You know, he did PSAs. He answered phones. He would, just say wacky stuff. You know, mm-hmm. he was just sort of one of the cast members along with Jungle Judy and Musical Mike and, mm-hmm. and Captain Chaos and some of, you know, the other Ludicrous Laurie, you know, Life Size Lynn. I mean, that was all. And after I met Al, I sort of became, I would come down every week or two or three and answer phones and just sort of be there sometimes, whether Al was there or not.
Mm-hmm.
And for a short time, you know, for a year maybe, I guess I was sort of one of the cast members.
That's great.
Know, but not to the extent that, you know, that Mike and Damascus and some of them were, you know, Sulu,
mm-hmm.
Sue Lubin. Who married a guy named Duboff, so she became Sudu instead of Sulu. Or Suludu, I guess. Sulu-Du.
How did your work with Al escape being novelty? When? And was it conscious? Like, because it definitely did. It's its own thing now.
It's its own thing, and I guess the parent genre is novelty.
Mm-hmm.
But that includes satire.
Yeah.
And comedy.
Mm-hmm.
And comedy is not necessarily novelty.
Uh-huh.
But it's novel in that I guess it has a sort of a narrow appeal.
Mm-hmm.
Although, you know, judging by the thousands of people that come to see us every night, you wouldn't think it's that narrow.
Yeah.
I mean, there's some major big bands that are out there, you know, that are well respected that, you know, would love to play some of the venues we do.
Yeah.
But again, this is after years and years and years, after decades of building a following, mm-hmm. and we've hung on to that following, and it's not because it's novel; it's just because it's good.
Yeah.
And I remember the first time it was '99 is the first time we videoed the show to produce a product a live concert, VHS and DVD.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very hard to tell on stage. I mean, you can put a camera out front and shoot the show. You know, just have kind of a one view of the show and the audience noise and get a little bit of a sense of what it is, but you never know.
No, yeah.
But in watching this properly mixed and edited camera work and proper lighting and everyone doing a really good show that night, yeah, I really got a sense of what it is that people, you know, why they come to the show multiple times.
Yeah.
Know, it's the same show. Why would you come several times?
Right.
It's a
right.
good show. Well, it's like if you like a certain TV show or a certain movie
mm-hmm.
or something, you may watch it several times.
Of course. Yeah.
You know, I mean, I still watch I Love Lucy.
Yeah.
You know, when it's on and Bewitched. And, you know, it's stuff I've seen, you know, Columbo episodes. You know, it's stuff I've seen to death.
Yeah.
And I watch them because I like them. And it's like, God, this, I'm watching us do our show from an angle that I never see it.
Sure, yeah.
And thinking, I get why people, this is actually very good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Even though I'm in it, I can separate myself, and it's like, this is, I would go see this.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not 20 times, you know, on the same show, but,
sure.
You know, once or twice or three times would be plenty, but yeah. It's very, very good. And the same thing again, when we did in 2011, we did the Apocalypse tour
mm-hmm.
on, actually at the beginning of that tour, we made a video of the tour mm-hmm. that went on sale almost immediately. It's like, well, do I go to the show or do I buy a, right. buy a DVD? Well, I'll go to the show and buy the DVD there.
Of course.
And I watched that and it's like, yeah, still, I get it. I know why it's grown.
Mm-hmm.
And it's still, you know, well, that was only a few years ago
mm-hmm.
and it continues to grow. I mean, we've, you know, it's not an accident that we're playing some of the biggest and most important venues of our career.
Yeah.
And the kind of classic venues that major acts play. I mean, the Hollywood Bowl is not some, you know, club in a college town in upstate New York.
Right. Right.
You know, we've done that.
Yeah.
You know, at a time when we should have been playing clubs.
Sure. Yeah.
But we've grown, and it's yet to level off.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll see what the future brings. You know, the plan is to go out in 2018
mm-hmm.
for a while, and the show is going to be. I don't think Al's made a secret of it. It's going to be primarily originals.
Oh God, are you kidding me?
Our originals.
Yeah. Are you kidding me?
No, that's you what just, you know. That's this is oh, this is it's no, for the fans. It's
so good.
It's for the fans who have let us know. It's like, you guys don't do enough originals. Yeah. Well, we got 14 albums worth of parodies.
Yeah,
you know, with a single or two or three from some of them
mm-hmm.
that we have to do. There's not a whole lot of room for originals,
of course.
You know, and we don't want to go up and play for 5 hours.
Yep.
So we've the balance of parodies to the ratio to originals is pretty high.
Yeah,
that's changing.
Yeah.
In 2018.
Oh my gosh, that's amazing.
There'll be some parodies,
mm-hmm.
but it's primarily originals. And we're also, and again, Al has kind of made this known, no costumes, no video, no backing tracks, you know, no percussion loops or anything.
Yeah.
We are just playing, and for better or worse.
Holy crap.
And we're just playing like we used to do a long time ago. And I'll just, I wear what I'm wearing now or uh-huh. wear a t-shirt or whatever, you know, or just,
yeah.
or if I don't want to shave, I don't have to shave.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And we'll just do a concert,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's not the show, it's a concert.
Yeah. Oh my gosh.
And I think the fans are going to dig that because we're going to play stuff that we've never played as a band.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Really. I was wondering that, like there have to have been a few things that have just never popped up on stage, right? Just studio.
Oh, there are a lot of stuff we've never played.
Crazy.
There's a lot of things we haven't played in a long time.
Yeah.
And a lot of stuff coming up. I mean, I already know there's a list of 50, 60 songs. And no, we're not playing 50 songs a night.
Right, right.
What that means is it's going to be a different show every night.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's that's also the lure. So people that are like, you know, they want to come to see the show because they like seeing the show.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to come now because they know they're going to see something different than they did last night.
Of course, of course.
So when we're in a region, we're going to have a lot of repeat business.
Yeah.
Just so they can hear the different things we're going to do. I mean, in theory... No show will be like, every show will be unique to some extent.
I mean, every time we talk about your music on the show, which has, of course, happened plenty of times, In 3D is the first album that we ever talked about because my best friend and I became friends over that album.
Mm.
Like, this is, that's the reason I started the podcast, is this damn album. And I love it so much, but that's the one thing that comes up is every nerd that I talk to, and we're all nerds, it's just like, why does nobody talk about the originals? And it is like just a huge thing, I think, for like, maybe it's a badge of honor. Maybe it's just like, well, you don't really know Weird Al unless you know those originals. And my phone's on. That's super classy. That was really great. We turned that off. That has almost never happened. but yeah, I mean, that's the thing, is those originals are just so hugely important. And my next question was going to be about, is it weird for you having to play somebody else's song, essentially, even though... And do you make it your own? Can you make it your own? I don't know what it's like.
Well, for on the parodies...
Yeah.
No, it's not weird for me.
No.
At all. What's weird is sometimes in one of my other bands, I'll be playing a song that we've parodied.
Okay, yeah.
And now I'm hearing some... And very often, we'll make a change of arrangement, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's... One of my bands plays... I love rock and roll.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we happen to do the exact arrangement of that song.
Yeah.
And I know the exact, you know,
of course.
I don't even have to think about it.
Yeah.
But we also do American Idiot.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and they do it much more like Green Day.
Okay.
That arrangement. And I have to really think about that.
Yeah.
And it's weird, even though it's the same part and it's pretty close to what I've been doing for years, I really have to think about it because it's not that familiar to me.
Okay.
Because it's now, it's like I'm not hearing the words I'm used to hearing.
Yeah.
So sure. I actually have to think about that. I'm on my toes with that one. Or if somebody wants to do, well, there's a number of the songs, you know, a lot of the older songs where these bands will play the original version of it. And I like to think I'm up to speed on it, but, you know, I'm not always. Now, with Al's originals, when we're doing those originals, those, I have somewhat made those my own because in a lot of cases, I mean, in every case, those are my parts.
Yeah.
So if I like the parts I played on the record, and I usually do, those are the parts I play. Sometimes if we played a song for years and years and years, it's, you know, something will occur to me. Oh, I wish I had done this instead. You
yeah.
know, I'm going to start playing this.
Yeah.
Just a little bit of a change up. And, you know, but not something I could have done at the time.
Sure.
You know, not something, you know, it takes years sometimes to have a part occur to me that it's like, oh, that would have been nice, you know, if I'd had several years to think about it before recording it. But sometimes we only had several weeks. Al would present a song. It's like, okay, hurry up and figure out the parts you want to do. And those are going to be the parts forever.
Yeah.
That's going to be committed to, you know, some media for all eternity. So make it good. It's like, I don't know. You know? I mean, I'm pretty happy with the stuff I did. It's a couple of things I would do different. But, you know, not to the extent that, you know, I don't agonize over it.
Yeah.
You know, or I wouldn't re-record it if given the opportunity. I
mean, sure, sure.
You know, although that would be interesting to go in and re-record an album of originals.
I'd listen to it.
Just with today's slant on it. Now, interestingly, we did the movie that came out last week, I think, How to Be a Latin Lover. With, he's a major Latin star named, I called him Eugenio. It's Eugenio.
Oh, okay.
Valdez, God, I can't even, anyway, Eugenio. and this is like his first movie geared towards the American market, towards the English speaking market. And it actually was like the number two movie last week. And it's like number four this week or something. I mean, it's really hanging in there.
Wonderful.
Well, we had a little bit of a cameo in there. There's an outdoor scene. There's a birthday party. And they wanted to use the song Happy Birthday, which ironically was the very first real thing I recorded with Al, you know, intentionally, not got sucked into it like Another One Rides the Bus, but where we got together and said, okay, we're doing a song named Happy Birthday today. and I think the deal was they didn't want to license the original recording from Sony. Or it would have cost too much.
Okay.
Of course, every movie claims to be on a budget.
Sure.
And so we went in and re-recorded Happy Birthday, a la the, you know, the first album version.
Wow.
As closely, you know, as closely as we could.
Yeah.
Including Al's lyric about there's an Arab on every corner.
Was going to ask about that line today.
That's in there because that's the lyric.
Yeah, that's the lyric,
you know, that's... And it sounded pretty good.
Yeah.
And that's the version used in the movie.
That's amazing.
Now, to the casual listener, especially as quickly as it goes by, you never know. As it happens, and also not a secret, that's going to be on the medium rarities disc.
Oh, okay, good.
In the squeeze box set that's coming out November 24th.
Yeah.
On Sony Legacy Records and CDs.
Yeah.
Oh. Literally records and LP and CD.
Mm-hmm. That box set looks amazing.
It's going to be... It's going to be great. I have, again, with my archiving ways, I have curated essentially all of the photos in this 100-page booklet.
Really?
That's in there. In fact, just today, they said, hey, have you got any photos from, you know, we're up to the medium rarities. You know, everything is chronological. And we needed some photos that sort of represent the stuff that's on that disc.
Yeah.
Have you got anything from this, or this? I said, no. Yes. Happy birthday. Yes. I've got that. So I sent him pictures not only in the studio recording that, but, and literally just a few days later, we were on set. I got a nice picture of us in these white tuxedos, which we were playing in, but a nice posed picture of the four of us and the core band. And it was pretty cool. You know, it's neat being involved with the label, and it's not my first time where I've supplied stuff
to
the
label.
In fact, I'm apparently such an archivist, when it came time to issue the Essentials disc, which is a two-disc hits package that Sony/CBS/BMG, they have Johnny Cash and Elvis Presley. I mean, every major artist that's got enough material ends up on an Essentials disc. So there was first there was a two-disc version. A year later, there was another version with a bonus disc, Essentials 3.0.
Oh, wow, okay.
So there's Essentials 2.0, the Essential Weird Al Yankovic 3.0. Well, the cover photo they wanted was a photo that was shot, it was like a studio shot,
mm-hmm.
while we were with Sony. And they didn't have it.
Oh, my gosh.
And they said, have you got this photo? And so I had an 8x10, and I scanned the 8x10.
Holy cow.
Cleaned it up.
Yeah.
Sent it to Sony, and that's what's on the cover, is my scan.
Wow.
Of their own photo.
Wow.
So they're apparently not, you know, they let me be the archivist. That's fine.
Yeah, yeah.
So same with all the album covers that are being reproduced mm-hmm. for this set. I mean, they had the most recent ones.
Sure.
That were in a computer.
Sure.
Everything else, they no idea.
Of course.
I shot.
Mm-hmm.
And not the CDs, because those have all sorts of little dots on them and
stuff like that.
At the time all the albums came out, they would make 12-inch flats,
mm-hmm.
like high-quality printing, like the covers were.
Mm-hmm.
Even for albums that came out only on CD, they still do those 12x12 promo flats.
Mm-hmm.
So I had album-size flats clean of everything.
Wow.
I shot those, cleaned them up, you know, tweaked, did whatever.
Yeah.
And made them look better than they ever looked when they were new.
Amazing.
And sent those off to Sony.
Yeah.
I didn't even send them I sent them off so they could scan them.
That's insane.
They still have them.
Yeah.
I guess if anyone's entitled, they are.
Sure.
But it's just interesting, you know, for a a label that owns Weird Al's catalog, lock, stock, and barrel, that mm-hmm. they still have to come to me for stuff.
Right.
Which pleases me and amuses me somewhat.
Of course it does. Well, I got to, you know, I've had a lot of, one of my good friends now is a Firesign Theater's archivist. I've had a few other archivists.
Big fan of them.
Are you? Okay, good. Yeah. See, and
I used to know the tale of the giant rat of Sumatra, like from beginning to end.
Really?
I used to know that whole thing. Like I used to know Billy the Mountain. You know, from all of that stuff, and all of my friends did too. All of the mm-hmm. same people that listened to the Dr. Demento show were also fans of these same things. Credibility Gap.
Yeah. Oh gosh, I love them so much.
I mean, I knew all of that stuff.
Yeah.
Not so much anymore.
Phil Proctor was in here just this weekend, actually, and we interviewed him about Don't Crush That Dwarf. We're doing like one album at a time with him. And that's a ton of fun. And I had his buddy who's an archivist here. And every story you're telling me now is just the same kind of crap he has to deal with to do Firesign stuff and get that going. And that is so overwhelming. But like, that's clearly... So, well, I guess I was going to ask like how involved... I'm assuming Al writes everything, but then that could be a completely ignorant assumption.
No,
he writes absolutely everything.
He does, well, certainly lyrically.
Yes, lyrically.
And musically, mm-hmm. on the originals, of course.
Mm-hmm.
There are certain things he'll specify
mm-hmm.
for each of us. Sometimes there's times he'll say, you know, it's going to sound like this, you know the drill,
okay.
you know what to
okay.
do.
Okay, right.
He gives direction, of course, as he should. He's the artist, the writer, and the producer.
Sure.
And the payroll clerk.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So you know, he's the boss. He's the man, the guy, the one, the kid.
Yeah.
So yes, he should be telling us what he wants, but mm-hmm. it just depends to what extent. Sometimes he really wants something very specific. I need a specific bass part here. I need a specific little keyboard. I want a specific drum fill here.
Yeah.
You know, or I want it to sound like this, but I don't want what they did on that album, you know, that we're sort of alluding to. I don't want it to sound like we're just stealing from that.
Right.
So in a lot of cases, you know, and with all of us, we have to sort of, on the originals, put ourselves, when we're doing what came to be known as style parodies, whether mm-hmm. it's The Doors or White Stripes or whoever it is, we have to put ourselves in the mindset of those players.
Mm-hmm.
What would they do if they were coming in? You know, what would John Densmore, the Doors drummer, do if he was coming in to play on Craigslist
mm-hmm.
and told, I want you to sound like you're playing with the Doors, but I don't want you to necessarily play what you played with the Doors, but
right.
I want people to think that it sounds like something you would have played.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I had to do.
Yeah.
Because I had to be John Densmore for a day.
Yeah.
And without being him, I had to allude to him. And I mean, there's only so much you can't do.
Yeah.
You know, there's some things you have to do.
Yeah.
There's production value that lends itself to those things. There's some signature parts,
mm-hmm.
you know. But, you know, without trying to just copy a particular song.
Yeah.
So, you know, Craigslist had, you know, some very obvious Riders in the Storm, you
mm-hmm,
know, kind of
mm-hmm.
thing going on, et cetera, et cetera. So in doing the originals, you know, sometimes we're left to our own devices, and you know, but Al has the final say on everything.
Sure.
And yes, he does, you know, he writes everything. He may ask for an opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Well, which line do you like better? Do you like this line or do you like this line? Or if I say this word in this line, like he said First World Problems.
Mm-hmm.
There
mm-hmm.
was an original line, and I have it on his original demo, something about butt hurt.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And he says to me, he says, do you know what butt hurt means? And at the time I did, and I said, no.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose I could Google it.
Mm-hmm.
Must be the kids are probably saying that.
Right.
It turns out they were.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah.
You know? And he knew that. But it's just like, well, would somebody who's, you know, yeah, you're an old fogey, but you're also involved in the arts and you listen to a lot of music, would you possibly know the reference? And I didn't.
Yeah.
And he pulled that line.
Wow.
He changed it to something else.
Yeah.
For me.
Yeah.
You know, I wish he left it in. Now I know what it means.
Right.
Now it would be very funny. Yeah. You know, perhaps if we do that song live.
There we go.
You know, he'll put the original lyric back in.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's welcome to change the lyrics on his own songs.
You know, of course.
They're his songs.
Of course.
sometimes if he, it doesn't happen often,
mm-hmm.
you know, but once every 4 or 5 or 6 shows on a parody,
mm-hmm.
He'll forget a lyric, but that doesn't mean he stops singing.
Yeah.
He'll say something else. And sometimes it fits and it's funny.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes he just stumbles his way through it. But
yeah.
More often than not, he puts in like just a different lyric that it's like, well, that works. Hey, you know, he says, it's my song. I'll change the lyrics if I want. Okay.
I mean, I know how excited I am to see you guys live, and I probably wouldn't notice. I'd be just too high on how amazing the show is, you know?
But the fans know because they're singing along.
Sure. Sure.
And all of a sudden, Al sang something different.
Al forgot
the lyrics. He sang something even funnier this time.
Right. And I mean, I guess that's my question is if you're obviously so heavily involved, regardless of, you don't have to write the song to have left your stamp on it or to enjoy it, to actually have it be a piece of art for you, you know, but you're also so invested that you're the archivist. So you must love it so much, maybe even more than any of us fans can appreciate.
Well,
because that's a lot of work.
You know, I didn't start out deliberately doing that.
Yeah.
I just always did that.
Yeah.
With all of my groups.
Yeah.
I mean, I have, with this group Nipper, I have a whole box full of, I have all the original paste-ups I did for the single that we put out.
Amazing.
I mean, I you know, I've just got all that. I've got a ticket from every show we did.
Mm-hmm.
I've got photos, I got tapes, I got rehearsals, I got gigs, I got, you know, posters we did. I mean, I've got all of that stuff. It was just something I did.
Yeah.
When Al came along, it was just something I did.
Yeah.
You know, the night I met him, I started archiving.
Yeah.
I had to enter Metro Media Square, which was the owner of Channel 11 at the time,
mm-hmm.
and KMET,
mm-hmm.
The Mighty Met, Metro Media, was housed there as well. It was Sunset and the Hollywood Freeway,
mm-hmm.
in Hollywood, and you know, it was sort of a secure facility even back then. So you had an access card, a little handwritten pass for the night,
mm-hmm.
and Dr. Demento had a bunch of those sort of pre-signed. So he would write them out for the people that were coming that night.
Mm-hmm.
We would meet him. He would hand us the cards. So if we saw anyone in the inside, it's like, okay, I've got my card. I'm okay to be here.
Mm-hmm.
I kept that card. You know, even that first night,
yeah.
even though it was just a chance meeting, I still have that card.
Yeah.
And it's in perfect condition.
It's amazing.
I mean, it's absolutely pristine.
I love it.
And so the night I met him, I began archiving.
Yeah.
And everything we did, you know, I always had a camera with me. I didn't have one that night, as it turns out, on subsequent visits to the show I did.
Mm-hmm.
But every time we were in the studio, every gig, every tour, rehearsals,
mm-hmm.
TV shows, everything, I always had a camera. And I just took photos endlessly.
Yeah.
Sometimes I had two cameras. One had, you know, SLRs. One,
uh-huh.
one had black and white film.
Mm-hmm.
The Minolta SRT-101, which is an older camera,
mm-hmm.
by the 80s, had black and white. And that was a real workhorse. And I had a Canon AE-1 program that I shot color.
Mm-hmm.
And I had some different lenses. But I had a big camera case that had all my gear in it, and it went everywhere with me on the road. And, of course, in order to see the pictures as we went along, I had to go to a lot of one-hour Photoshop.
Of course, yeah.
And I always got two sets of photos,
mm-hmm.
one to keep and one to hand out.
Yeah.
You know, or one to put in my box of photos. There were the Al photos and there were the me photos.
Mm-hmm.
So depending who was in the photo, you know, one set just went into the archive and the other set got handed out, and, you know, maybe any extras went into my another photo album I had.
Yeah.
So it was a very expensive pursuit.
Of course.
Looking back.
Of course.
You know, I was always, I never had the luxury of doing stuff overnight because we were always on the move. And I would shoot, you know, 20, 30 rolls of film during the course of a short tour, you know, to 2-3 rolls a week maybe. So it was an expensive deal before I knew how to write things off. I wish I could go back. It's too far to go back and revise my taxes. But I've got all of those photos. Every stinking single photo is in a box in order, in a box, in several boxes in order. There are the Weird Al boxes. There are the Me boxes. There's a little bit of crossover between the two. Mm-hmm. But there was a point where I realized, you know, it doesn't matter which box they go into, I'll be able to find it. Mm-hmm. I don't need duplicates. You know, if I'm in a photo with Al, does it go in his box or mine? Mm-hmm. Well, after a certain point, it just went in mine.
Yeah.
and I know to find it later. And at this point, after going through the collection of photos and posters and all the other stuff for Behind the Music, for the Unauthorized Al book, in 1985, for the box set book in 1994, for the Weird Al book in 2012, Driven biography, label needs this, label needs that. Now the label, you know, has gotten tens of thousands of my photos for this booklet. Obviously, they're not using them all. In doing that, most of the stuff I've got has been digitized more than once. Scanned, digitized, or there was a point where they were just all digital. I went through recently and reordered all of my photos. I had an interesting experience with the guy who put together the Weird Al book with us, and Nathan
Raven.
Yes. And he came over to my house for a couple of weekends, went through all my stuff with me.
Wow.
Went to Al's house, went through all of his stuff, but he went through every photo in my collection.
Oh my.
That had thereunto been in order. And they got seriously out of order. He would group them and stack them, then like just gather them up and stick them back in the box more or less within the year that of, you know, the index card for that year. And they had been that way ever since. They've been that way for over 5 years now. Except when I needed to find something for Sony just like last week. And it's like, okay, I need to find something from this video shoot. I'm going to go look for it.
Yeah.
And I realized, was reminded how out of order everything was. I thought, okay, that's it. And I spent 2 solid days putting everything back in order.
Oh, my.
And I realized it was then I could tell a very obviously cut off when things went digital. After which, maybe 2003 was the last year I had any kind of real photos.
Okay.
And after that, there were some years I had no hard copies at all.
Yeah.
None. I think the most recent hard copy photo, I've got one photo from 2012 that somebody else gave me.
Okay.
But 2003 to 2004 was the cutoff where I went 100% digital. And I had already been using a digital camera, but I've been through so many digital cameras because the quality just gets better and better. But at this point, hopefully I don't have to go through all those photos again. Everything that's worth seeing, I think, has been scanned and digitized and cataloged and renamed in order with the photographer's name on it, you know, usually me.
Yeah.
And hopefully now this stuff's been digitized to the point where I don't have to touch another photo.
Of course.
You know, now that I've put them all in meticulous order, that's probably the last time I have to refer to them.
Yeah.
But that's the extent to which I take my archiving very seriously. And it's not just photos. It's Al's product or product that has an Al reference. There are a lot of albums, CDs, where Al has been thanked for one reason or another.
Sure, yeah.
If his name appears on it, I get a copy.
Yeah.
I buy it, or I mooch one, or whatever, or I refer to it, at least in the discography, if I can't get one.
Sure.
And I still discover something. I keep on top of it pretty well these days, but I still occasionally discover something that's like, God, I got to get that. Or how didn't I know about that just 5 years ago, you know, when the internet, you know, would allow me to find it.
Of course.
20 years ago, I don't know how I knew all those things. You know, I mean, I was online 20 years ago, but it wasn't the resource that it is now.
Yeah.
So I've got a collection of product from around the world, video, audio, promo items, radio station things, different distributors. I've got our CD catalog with 4 different distributors. EPA, which is Epic Portrait Associated Labels, which was CBS. They, they were our first distributor with Scotti Brothers. Then they went to, I think they went to BMG.
Okay.
Reissued all the CDs on BMG. By this point, I think there were no more LPs. So all the LPs up to that point were Epic. After that, there might have been a couple of BMG, but then it was strictly CD. Then they got distribution with Warner's, WEA. So everything was reissued under WEA.
Wow.
And I would go out and seek different versions. They had different catalog numbers. The early CDs had full artwork. The later ones didn't. For various reasons.
Interesting.
You know, they repressed, not repressed, but repressed the CD. So the CD catalog numbers, of course, and the label art was sometimes a little bit different. So those all are in the archive as well.
Yeah.
When Sony took over, reissued all the CDs, had to go get them all again.
Oh my gosh.
You know, I've got them in under Scotti Brothers. I got them in their original long boxes, and they're all shrink wrapped.
Oh, wow.
So they're brand new. Wow. Some of them may be promo items, but they're all brand new.
Does the internet once told me, and it could be it's the internet, so it could be mistaken, that there that Off the Deep End was released on vinyl somewhere in Europe? I haven't been able to find it or enough information to find out. So I use that as an excuse to talk about it on the podcast, but I don't know.
Okay. It was released on vinyl probably as a bootleg, I think either from Korea or the Philippines.
Okay.
There was Smells Like Nirvana was released as a 12-inch with the Off the Deep End artwork.
Okay.
In Britain.
Okay, interesting.
I believe.
I didn't know.
Maybe German. I don't know. But that was like a 12-inch single novel. You know, not novelty, but a niche
kind
of a thing. But yeah, CDs had certainly taken over by that point. I remember remarking to Al in '89 when we were wrapping up UHF. I said, "This is," and everything was coming out still on cassette, mind you. So cassette, CD, LP. I said, "You know, this is probably going to be our last vinyl album."
Yeah.
And, you know, officially issued by our label. And I was right, as it turns out. So for Off the Deep End, it was just CD and cassette. If there was a European album on vinyl, I'll have it in my archive.
I don't doubt it.
Off the top of my head.
I don't doubt it.
And I don't have the archive's not available online. I can't look at it.
Right.
The discography is, but it's a U.S. discography because everything outside of the U.S., even Canada, is very hard to pin down.
I would imagine.
And if I can't be 99% complete, I don't want to do it at all.
I understand
that. I don't want to have anything not be accounted for. If it's in the U.S., well, all of Al's albums and product and reissues and all that are all accounted for. There might be a promo thing here that I'm not aware of, you know, stuff like that.
Of course.
But Europe and Asia and Australia and South America are very hard to pin down.
I would imagine.
And Canada as well. And so I kind of don't even try in terms of the discography. So I call it a U.S. discography.
Makes sense.
And that's relied on as the official discography.
Do you know what? I should ask you, because this has been fascinating, but I haven't asked you, do you have a favorite original that you guys play? Is there like one that either is super fun to play, super fun to listen to? I'm curious, because I have some weird deep cuts that I don't know if anybody else cares about, but I'm curious, like, what's...
Well, the deep cut, you're going to hear deep cuts on this next tour.
I can't wait. That's just, that
gave me
chills.
You're going to hear stuff that none of us want to play, but it's just to like bring it out and you know, for the fans who would never otherwise.
Of course.
You know, stuff we've never played live and sometimes for good reason. I don't know. You know, that's the most difficult question I have is, you know, what's your favorite song? Mm-hmm. What's your favorite original? What's your favorite album?
Sure.
And I just... You know, it's usually album wise. Now it's usually the most current album because one, it's fresh.
Of course.
Two, we you know, with each album we grow. We grow as players. We grow as programmers. Our listening abilities grow. Our technical abilities grow, and so every album is, for various reasons, better than the last. I think Al's humor gets better. It's not as goofy, silly, you know, food related as it once was.
Sure.
It's very, it's I don't want to say it's more adult.
Right.
It's just, it's more honed. It doesn't rely on being goofy in a way. And there's still a little bit of that. Mm-hmm. But it's not all about just being goofy and outrageous. He's got some very incisive,
absolutely,
you know, commentary. I mean, there's some social commentary going on.
That's why Trigger Happy always stands out to me much. I love that song
Whether he believes it or not, mm-hmm. whether he's sending a message or not, and sometimes he does and sometimes he doesn't, mm-hmm. It's just he knows that it's something that will raise somebody's awareness and get them to think.
Yeah.
You know, while you know, that's not always the goal. He's not writing stuff to get people to think, but right. it's while he's at it, you know, it's like, well, I can be funny and maybe get someone to stop and think about something. You know, this is important. Or some people think this is important. Maybe, you know, my listeners should be aware of this.
Of course.
You know, but not something he wouldn't ever put, you know, something like that in the liner notes, you know, visit Save the Whales. You
of
know,
course. And, right. Yeah. That would defeat the purpose. Yeah.
Donate to, you know, eat the animals or whatever. Oh, he doesn't eat animals. Whatever.
Eat the animals. What,
you know, or don't eat the animals. DonateTheAnimals.com. And tell them Al sent you. Now, you know, favorite song? I like them all.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's nothing that I dread playing. It's nothing that I fall asleep while I'm playing. Uh-huh. It's nothing like, God, why do we have to play this song? Because in the case of the originals, those are all my parts. So, I mean, it would be sort of hypocritical for me to say, oh, I don't like this song.
When
I'm doing what I did on it, you know, I get to replay the parts that are the parts.
Sure.
You know, that are things that I made up or that Al told me that I should be making up or whatever it was. You know, that's stuff that I'm proud of. So in that respect, I like them all. Now, there's some things, and come up on this tour, we are doing some of the longer songs.
Mm-hmm.
Some of these long songs are fast songs.
Yeah.
Some of them are about cities in New Mexico.
Uh-huh.
Not the capital, but the other one.
Sure.
And so there are songs that's like, God, I got to play at top speed for 13
for
minutes.
13 minutes.
After we've already played for an hour. Now also, with the new concert format coming up and without videos, to enable costume changes that we won't be doing.
Mm-hmm.
So no videos, no screen, no costumes, no nothing. We're going to be playing. I mean, I'm not going to get a break. I'm not going to get 3, 4, 5 minutes here and there.
Oh, man.
Go back and have a drink of water, sit in front of a fan.
Yeah.
I'm playing. We're playing nonstop.
Wow.
Well, eventually we will stop.
Uh-huh.
So it's going to, you know, there are songs that it's like, God, I hope we don't have to do that one every night.
Yeah. Yeah.
Albuquerque is okay. It's on the list.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't think it's going to get played every night.
Right.
But there are some other rather lengthy songs.
Yeah.
That are going to get played, and so we get into those. And it's like, you know, I got to play nonstop for 7, 8, 9 minutes, whatever it is. You know, 11 minutes, 15 seconds, whatever Albuquerque is.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, favorite songs, they're all, I like them all.
Yeah. That's a reasonable answer.
I do.
I can't fault you because I also like them.
It's very hard. It would be impossible to pick 1 or 10 or 50.
Sure.
And we have, you know, 14 albums worth of songs. There's a lot of songs. And a lot of songs that were never recorded that we've played.
I know. Gosh.
Originals and parodies, you know.
I can't wait for this. I got chills when you mentioned the whole format. I'm like, oh, goodness, you've just designed a concert for me. That's so amazing.
Well, that's was Al's thinking. It's like, you know what, this is just for the fans. It's not for the people who's like, wow, Al got a number one album. He must be really special.
Right.
We'll buy it. We wouldn't normally, but we'll buy, you know, he's hung in there for 30 plus years. We better see his show before, you know, one of us dies.
Right.
And that's not a bad thing. You know,
of course.
It's like when you're popular, it's like people gravitate.
Yeah.
But the fans have always been there, and we've got new young fans.
Yeah.
And a lot of them will be at these shows. And we've got fans that have been with us 20, 25, 30 years longer.
I love seeing multi-generational groups that come.
Oh, it's
the shows. It's amazing.
It's an extremely wide demographic in the audience. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's 5-year-olds, there's 65-year-olds. Well, the 65-year-olds are on stage. there's it's a very wide demo, and unlike, I don't remember exactly when it changed, but in the very early days, Al's appeal, well, because you know so closely related with Dr. Demento,
mm-hmm.
was more towards kind of adolescent males,
sure,
junior high school, maybe college men,
mm-hmm.
boys. Very few females at mm-hmm. the time. So we would go do shows, and it was rare to see girls in the audience. I mean, it was the crowd that liked Monty Python and Three Stooges and stuff like that, and Fireside Theater.
Of course.
And Weird Al. Well, over time, you know, certainly by the early to mid-90s, that had changed, and it was very much a 50-50 kind
mm-hmm.
of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if it was Al's appeal or if the guys had gotten were old enough to start dating and bringing their girlfriends.
Right, that makes sense.
I mean, I can understand why some of the nerdy guys back in the day didn't have girls with them.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it was partly the girls didn't like it, and partly they probably couldn't get any girls.
Right.
that's changed a lot.
Yeah.
And, you know, with all due respect to the male nerds out there.
Of course.
There are plenty of female nerds,
too. Of course, yeah. I'm married to one. She goes to the shows with me, you know. That's nice, right?
It's a very... And then the age range has expanded tremendously. And it's not just the fans from 20 years ago bringing their kids now.
Mm-hmm.
It's fans from 20 years ago. Sometimes there's, you know, their kids are there. Sometimes there's new fans that are young, mm-hmm. 5-year-olds, 10-year-olds, whatever. You know, anyone really who can understand lyrics and, you know, has enough money to buy a ticket, we love them. they're what we... No, that's terrible. No, if their parents buy a ticket, that's good. No, you know, anyone who sort of gets what we do, I mean, it's kind of an ageless thing
mm-hmm.
anymore. It's the adults get stuff. You know, if there's something a little bit blue
mm-hmm.
in Al's, you know, lyrics, and, mm-hmm. and, you know, he's gotten to be kind of the master of that,
mm-hmm.
You know, over the years. You know, the parents know that it's kind of above the kids' heads.
Oh,
they don't have to worry about the kids hearing that, other than in 15 or 20 years, you know, the kids will go, darn, that's what he meant.
Right, right.
And then the parents, you know, Dad, why didn't you tell me that's what it was? You know, the parents have a different problem.
Right.
But, no, Al's, he's very good at knowing, how do I put this? He's careful about his lyrics in terms of, not because the kids, you know, don't hear these things
mm-hmm.
on TV and in other forms of music and in school and stuff like that. It's not that they don't hear words and lines and stuff that, you know, Al wouldn't say.
Mm-hmm.
He's concerned that their parents will hear them hearing it from Al.
Yeah.
And that reflects poorly on him.
Of course.
So he's able to sometimes convey a thought and couch it humorously, you know, typically, and get away with it. And he knows that the parents know that the kids won't know.
Yeah.
And, you know, till much later.
That's the art of it. And I love it. And
he's very good at that. And there's a little bit of that on each album.
Yeah. Okay. So, normally we sort of wrap up. I say, why would you talk about this album? We're not talking about one album. We're talking about, you know, a career that is still going strong for several dudes all at once who all have their own input. But I would like to, I don't know when this will come out, but what do you want to promote? Where can people find you online?
Well, I am online at bermudaschwartz.com,
mm-hmm.
BERMUDASCHWARTZ, .com, M like in summer. And any other pertinent links are on there. Of course, Weird Al is weirdal.com.
Mm-hmm.
And I had set that up many years ago. I was his webmaster in the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
I was his webmaster when it wasn't even his site.
Yeah.
It was my site about my experience with him.
Amazing.
And it evolved into his site. And I got the weirdal.com domain, and I spelled W-E-I-R-D, which is correct.
Mm-hmm.
And then I also thought, well, everyone gets this wrong. Let's get W-I-E-R-D-A-L.
Of course.
And so we've still got that. So you cannot,
amazing.
You really have to go out of your way to spell Weird Al wrong to not get to the site.
Right.
So you can spell it either way. And we've got some fans who've become friends of ours over the years.
Mm-hmm.
And they went out and they sought weirdal.net, weirdal.org.
Wow.
And they have those forward.
That's great.
But basically weirdal.com
mm-hmm.
Is where everything Al mm-hmm. is. We converted that to a WordPress site. Mm-hmm. 2 years ago.
Okay.
And Al can maintain that.
Yeah.
If I go in to do some work on it, WordPress is too easy. I have to go in, look at all the code.
Yep.
And I can manipulate the code. If I'm looking at WordPress, I mean, I know it's supposed to be drag and drop, and you know, and it's just, I can't do it.
Right.
I have to go in and put tags and do all that, which I know, you know, that's how I learn. I still code.
Sure.
I'm the kids call me a coder or a codger. I forget. It's just one letter, whatever.
One letter off. That's fine.
But yeah, I still do websites for other clients.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not as feverishly as I used to.
Sure.
I mean, you know, all the WordPress and the Wix and places like that you can just have, they have all sorts of drag and drop ready
to
go stuff.
Yeah.
You really don't have to know how to do that stuff anymore. And, and frankly, I just haven't kept up with it.
Yeah.
So I'm not taking on any new clients at this time.
Smart.
But the Weird Al, the site was so deep. I had so many pages and so much information that when Sony agreed to host the site, as they did for almost all of their artists, because they controlled a lot of the promotion within the, those artists' site, they hosted it. They granted me access to their servers.
Wow.
Only so much access, because I did try to go up a level to get into their... I couldn't do it. I just wanted to see if I could get in there. They they knew I would do that. So I couldn't. But they let me into their server, and they hosted. And when they first got the site, they said, "We have never seen such a deep site."
Yeah.
I said, "Well, I started this site before anybody had websites."
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I did this site in 1995.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were extremely impressed. And the site is still pretty deep.
Oh, it's great. Yeah.
The photo galleries have made their way over to Instagram and Twitter these days, which Al controls.
Mm-hmm.
He feeds that. Facebook to an extent. So the site is a little bit static. It's used just sort of as a resource. All the tour dates are on there.
Mm-hmm.
Set lists are on there. Again, these came from my archives.
Mm-hmm.
The discography is hosted by Jeff Morris, who is Dr. Demento's archivist, I guess, Man Friday.
Yeah, he's also been on the show. We've had so many archivists on the show.
And Jeff is great. Jeff always hosted the discography.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why. It would have been simple enough to put on WeirdAl.com.
Oh, yeah,
but,
yeah.
But he said, I'll just put the text version of it up if that's okay, and you can link to it. I said, fine.
Yeah, why not?
So I always kept that updated, and I'm working on one that resembles the current WeirdAl.com format, the kind of gray, the little more austere format of that, and I just haven't... It's not completely up to date. There's just so many little things, thanks to Jeff Morris pointing out, well, you know, this thing didn't come out before this, and you've got it on the list here. And there was this other thing that came out here, and, well, you've got, you know, UHF, you know, came out on Blu-ray in this year, but you put Blu-ray up, you know, in the other thing, you know, up in 1989, but that couldn't have possibly been. So he catches me on a lot of stuff.
I love it.
And I've got a long list of things that I have to decide how to do it so that it meets with his standards, which are probably higher than mine. So I'm trying to please Jeff on,
of course.
You know, he's more meticulous than I am. But you know what? That's good.
Of course.
He keeps me in line.
When does Squeezebox come out again?
Squeezebox, street date on that is November 24th.
November 24th.
At the end of
2017.
And that's out in both LP and CD.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that's being accomplished is, if anyone hasn't been to the site that was promoting like the pre-sales on those, the way that works is they're not doing like a little tiny accordion for the CDs.
Yeah.
They're doing one size, and it's going to be a big square accordion because it has to obviously fit LPs.
Yeah.
They are making special jackets in the size of the LPs.
Really?
With a little pocket in the back that the CD goes into for the CD version so that it will fit in the same large box.
Oh my gosh, that's insane.
So for those people that have to have both versions, like me,
uh-huh.
they're going to have two of these big LP-sized accordion things.
That's hilarious.
The accordion doesn't play, sorry. The booklet is I've already got a copy of the first half of the booklet.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very collage-y kind of a thing. It's very, very cool. It's so cool to see these things. There's a lot of photos in there that have never been seen. Even with all the different outlets I've had for the photos and the archive, I pulled out a lot of new stuff for this.
I pulled out
stuff that's never been used.
Oh.
I pulled out contact sheets. And showed. Two guys from Sony came out to the house in 2014, 2015, sorry, before the tour began. They came out in April and spent a couple of weekends with me going through everything.
Wow.
More so than Nathan Rabin had done for the book.
Mm-hmm.
They went nuts.
That's insane.
And one of the guys, a guy named Mike Duquette,
is
a major Al fan.
Mm-hmm.
And he was kind of like, oh yeah, that's got to be in there.
Yeah,
he
sort
of qualified what you know, was going to be important to the fans.
I love it.
And it was pretty cool.
That's so good.
It was very, very cool. So I just recently got to see the booklet starting to take shape.
Mm-hmm.
They're working on the very end of it as we speak,
mm-hmm.
and I'll see the second half of it. You know, I've got PDFs basically of these, and not complete, but what they're intending. You know, nothing's been balanced or anything like that. But they've got the layout.
That's great,
and it's very, very cool.
Oh, I cannot wait.
It's really, there's a ton of stuff. It's like, man, the it's things. I mean, I've got photos, I've got contact sheets of negative strips that I shot in the studio that have never been printed.
Yeah. Wow.
I've got, so there's like contact sheets in this thing that people are going to go, wow, that looks like it would be a great photo if it was blown.
Right.
I've never printed any of these things.
Yeah.
You know, we did contact sheets and that was it.
Wow.
Of course, I've got all the negatives.
Sure.
If I ever, I could do my own book of stuff.
Yeah.
None of which is in the Sony book.
Yeah.
Mind you. Or Nathan's book.
Yeah. Oh, that's so good.
Or as I like to call it, my book. Or as Al likes to call it, the Weird Al book.
Uh-huh.
No, I curated probably 95% of the photos in that book. And
that's great.
Easily 99% of the photos in the book that's coming with the box set.
That's so good.
So I'm very happy to be involved to a much larger extent than most musicians are involved with their label.
Mm-hmm.
Which it's actually not even our label anymore.
Right. That's
the Al point. Very, very publicly... decided to not re-sign with Sony or anyone else.
Yeah.
After having a number one album. Number one, cool, goodbye.
Right.
No, actually, the departure was in the works.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And you know, with a number one album, I think both Sony and Al thought, maybe, I know Sony did. Sony
of course
certainly
did.
Wanted to continue the relationship.
Of course.
And Al was ready to essentially go independent.
Yeah.
And which is not a bad thing.
Sure. No.
I think being independent is great if you're at a point where you can be independent.
Mm-hmm.
I think if you're independent because you're just starting,
mm-hmm.
it's still a very tough road to hoe, as they say.
Yeah.
It's a very tough climb to... what do? You get hooked up with a label to not sell any albums?
Right.
you know, it's not... It's you know, and if you don't sell albums and you can't get the right promotion, can you go on tour and get anybody to come see you? Can you make money that way?
Right.
It's very difficult. You know, YouTube is great exposure, but it's how do you draw people to come see you there?
Of course.
And it's free. But it's like, well, how do you get people to go see you, and then will they come see you live and pay 5 or 10 or 20 bucks to come see you?
Right.
You know, can you do a college tour? Can you do... And it's tough. With Al and a lot of other artists that have left their labels, they're in a position, they're at a place where they can continue doing what they do.
Yeah.
And the labels have been great, but there's not actually a need. He doesn't resent it. It's just, I don't have to have a label.
Yeah.
They're not going to sell any more records than I can.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't book our tours. You know, everything, the whole rest of my career is separate from the label. If I'm not selling records, well, you know, why bother?
Yeah. Well, I'm very excited for the future. I cannot wait to go see you guys live next year. My gosh, this has just been a blast. Like, I obviously, you're welcome. If you want to come back on and talk about Firesign Theater, we could do that all day.
Well, I don't know that I still remember the tale of the giant rat of Sumatra. But I swear to God, I knew all the lines.
I love it.
The dog was blind. I tell you, I was so hooked on stuff from that album.
Mm-hmm.
And stuff from a lot of... Monty Python, I was a huge fan.
Sure.
I had the phone company list my name as Jim Blind.
Uh-huh.
So that in the phone book it would read Blind Jim, which was the dog, which was...
Oh, my God.
Hemlock Stone's dog in the show.
That's amazing. In the
album.
That's
Blind Jim.
Fantastic.
And I'll tell you how many you know, the Society for the Blind, how many people saw that and thought that was a reference to my being blind, would call that numbers. But I just thought that was so cool.
I hope for the sake of your archiving that you still have a copy of that phone book.
You know,
somewhere.
I don't.
Well,
it never occurred
what
to
year
me
was this? Somebody's got one.
78. 79.
There's a hoarder out there who 80. Has every phone book.
I lived in Glendale, so mm-hmm. if there was a Glendale... or a Valley phone book, mm-hmm. or a downtown area phone book.
That's so funny.
That so 78, 79, 80 would yeah. have been the year. And it's, of course, the phone number's no good, so feel free
of
to
course.
Call it. I don't remember the phone number. I have it written down somewhere. But it was that apartment, and mm-hmm. there's a couple of iconic photos. When the Placebo EP
mm-hmm.
Was pressed up, Al got them in plain white sleeves.
Mm-hmm.
He had also printed up what became the front and back cover, which was just an elongated... I guess a 7x14 uh-huh. sheet that he folded. And then he had like 7-inch, they weren't Mylar sleeves, but they were plastic sleeves.
Yeah.
And so we had like a Placebo EP assembly party at my apartment, which was me, Dr. Nemendo, and Al. And so there's pictures. Anytime you see a picture with Al holding up the Placebo EP
mm-hmm.
or Demento holding up one of the discs or whatever, and there's this horrible orange wallpaper in the mm-hmm. back, that's my apartment in Glendale. which is where I was living when I met Al.
Yeah.
I have other pictures of, it's where we recorded the Dr. Demento jingle.
Really?
That went, it was just drums and like temple blocks.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, I didn't sing on it, and you'll know why in a second, but it was the one, you hear it on the Dr. Demento show still. And it was Dr. Demento, Dr. Demento, Dr. Demento. Mm-hmm. And there's like this laughing at the end, which is he and I, and we left it in. And actually, I think we brought it in from the end of another song we had done.
Mm-hmm.
And we just like taped it, you know, edited it into the end of that.
That's great.
That is also on Medium Rarities.
That's fantastic.
And I remixed that. I have the original tracks on that in digital and everything separated. And I remixed a version, you know, under Al's supervision. And it's cleaner than it ever could have been.
That's amazing.
Because the copy Dr. Demento got was at least a second generation cassette.
Sure.
Of a cassette.
Right.
So it was only so clean.
Yeah. Oh.
This is the original Porta Studio cassette, so mm-hmm. it's as clean as that. It's like listening to that cassette. I'd never heard it so good.
That's amazing.
And so I won't get credit for remixing that.
Of course.
I think Pac-Man came from me.
Mm-hmm.
Which
is fantastic.
And that might have been a little bit of a remix. I had the Pac-Man music, and I had the Pac-Man vocals, and I think I comped that all from the masters.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's my mix as well.
Wow.
So that is also cleaner than anyone would have ever heard it.
Well, every nerd out there needs to pick that up. Needs to go see you guys live, like I'm definitely going to do. This has been, honestly, just so much fun. I really appreciate
this.
Well,
for me, it was a trip down memory lane.
Yeah. Well, I want to get your story. I wanted to get your side of things. I'm so fascinated with all the other stuff you did before, too. It was just mind-blowing. And I wish I'd have known that you were one of the first guys to get stuff played on Dr. Demento, but it's fun to discover that while you talk to somebody. Again, thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you guys very much for listening. And as always, have a good thing. Comedy on Vinyl is a production of Stolen Dress Entertainment. It is produced by Mike Warden and is hosted and edited by Jason Klom. Our theme song was composed and performed by Richard Levinson. Please visit stolendress.com to listen to our other podcasts, read our blogs, read our tweets, watch our videos, and read our books. Please subscribe on iTunes, and if you like us, give us a 5-star rating and a nice review. You can find us on facebook.com/comedyonvinyl, Twitter @comedyonvinyl, and find everything else at comedyonvinyl.com. A major portion of Comedy on Vinyl has been underwritten by Stand Up Records. Please visit standuprecords.com for all your comedy needs and tune into the new Stand Up channel available on the Roku, where you can also find select episodes of this podcast.